Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, I was on such a high from last week. I saw those four movies, and all four were awesome and good, and I was feeling good, and we have another four movies to talk about tonight. And they're not all good. In fact, one of them's complete garbage.
Yeah, but it's a mixed bag. It's a bit of a mixed bag. But if you'll recall last week, I said because we had had such a run of really weak wine connections to the films, that I felt that I was on a mission to find some beverage for this evening that would be spot on. And I got to tell you, I think I hit the nail on the head. It's very literal.
Well, you have showed up tonight with beer.
Mm-hmm.
I've popped the top, but I haven't looked at it. I see it's from Flying Dog, and I've been to that brewery recently. I went last month. My wife took me for my birthday to Flying Dog, which is just up north in Frederick, Maryland.
I had no idea.
So let's check it out from Flying Dog. That's what I guessed it was going to be, but I didn't think it'd be so literal.
It is very literal.
It's a hazy IPA called Night School.
Yep.
Flying Dog University.
Night School beer. I mean, can you get any more literal than for our first film of the night?
That's an ambitious beer. I mean,
is it got a good beer?
It's got a taste on it. You know what I mean? Oof. It's pretty good, but it's
wow.
Yeah, isn't it? I think, is there lemon in there, maybe?
I don't know. That's an interesting one.
But yeah, our first film is Night School. It's the widest release we're going to talk about this weekend. And once again, it's Kevin Hart playing Kevin Hart. I think I've seen him play this character before in Ride Along 2, Central Intelligence. You know, the guy where he makes fun of his own height, makes fun of himself, and everything he says is either screamed or yelled.
And all the, everything seems to be working against him, but he's got a good heart.
You know, does he? I wonder if he really does.
Oh, come on.
So Kevin Hart, back in high school, he had a problem. He just couldn't focus. He wasn't a good test taker. He didn't know why. The audience off the bat knows why. It's not really a secret. But during the SATs, he stands up, says, "This is culturally biased. I quit. I'm out of school." He drops out of school. Flash forward 17 years later, and he's doing pretty well for himself.
Yeah, as a salesman.
He's an ace salesman selling barbecue grills at Barbecue City. When the boss retires, he's just going to hand him over the store. He's about ready to propose to his girlfriend Lisa, played by Megalyn Echewoke. I wrote it down.
I was like, I had no idea how to say that.
Echekunwoke.
Uh-huh.
Echekunwoke. I never watched it, but apparently she's from CSI Miami.
Oh, okay.
And he doesn't make a lot of money, but he pretends he does. He's living above his means. And boom, he's clumsy. Teddy Walker is clumsy, and he blows up his employment. And he can't get another job because he's a high school dropout. So last resort, he enrolls as night school.
Yeah.
His teacher is fresh out of girls' trip, Tiffany Haddish. She's no nonsense. She's not just handing out leaflets and helping you cheat to get your GED. She wants you to learn this material. And Teddy Walker's going to take him a couple tries to understand that lesson. The best part about night school, easily, is the nutballs, the misfits in that class. I really like them. And I think if night school had stayed within that classroom more, instead of going out Teddy solo, I wouldn't be ragged on night school so much. I really liked some, if not most, of those oddball characters.
I agree.
I liked Rob Riggle as the dumb jock.
Mm-hmm.
I liked Romany Malco as the paranoid blue-collar man. I liked Ann Winters as the rebellious teenager. I really liked the mom, Mary Lynn Rice Cub.
Is that how you say her name from 24?
I happened to see her last night in a very recent episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Uh-huh. She plays Gail the Snail.
Oh, I just remember as
she was
Chloe.
In 24, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I really, they're funny. And one guy, Fat Joe, in fact, a rapper, if you know who that is, Skypes in from prison. And it's really amusing. But unfortunately, night school doesn't really take place so much in the classroom as out in the world of Teddy just kind of screwing up his life. And why does Teddy have to go to that school? Is that the only place you can go to night school where your former enemy is the principal who has it out for you?
But he didn't know that at the time. He thought that he'd be able to just get an easy pass, you know, by going back to his old high school. He has no idea that his nerd nemesis from back in those days is now the principal. And so, yeah, I mean, really, he stays there to get his GED because otherwise you wouldn't have a movie. And,
I still don't think we have a movie.
I agree with you that the ensemble, this is an ensemble comedy. And unfortunately, if they strayed, there are a couple of issues. One, when the film is opening, you see that there are six freaking writers credited with this screenplay. When you have six writers on what should be no more than a 90-minute comedy that is bloated to close to 2 hours, you know you have a problem. The second problem is that the director, Malcolm D. Lee, who did Girls Trip and who did like the Best Man franchise, he and Kevin Hart, I think, decided they were going to let this great ensemble of cast of comedic characters ad-lib and improv as much as they wanted to. And so I think the combination of a bloated script and improv, it just made a good premise into a bit of a muddied mess. And that's where it all fell apart. I equated this whole entire movie, if you saw the sitcom Community, it's sort of that same premise. And so this was like a very bloated episode of Community and just not as witty. And I agree with you 100% that it's when they take you outside of that misfit cast of characters ensemble, that's when this film really goes off the rails.
I see the Community connection loud and clear. It fits. This is a really heavy 1980s material. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of school movies back then. Summer School, Gross Anatomy. Rodney Dangerfield did the Older Man Goes Back to School in Back to School. This just has 80s material all over it, but it's just not as funny as that. Malcolm D. Lee, by the way, is Spike Lee's cousin. And he has been great in the past. He was great in Girls Trip, but the material is better. He was great in Undercover Brother. I loved that movie. So they took the director, the breakout star, and most of the crew from Girls Trip, and they couldn't make another movie out of that because the script is just you're right, six people and this is what they came up with.
And it's way too long. I mean, it got painful as you passed the 90-minute mark and realized that this film was going to continue going, and you know that it's going to have the totally formulaic, predictable aspects of there's going to be a misunderstanding. Kevin Hart's character Teddy doesn't tell his fiance that he's going to night school and that he's maxed out on cash and all these things. And you know that when you lie to your fiance, it's going to come back to haunt you. And then, of course, in the end, you also know that this band of misfits, it's sort of like the Breakfast Club at night, is going to eventually all bond and learn life lessons from each other.
The Breakfast Club. They walk in the morning, and all they can see is their differences. And by the afternoon, deep down, we're all the same.
Exactly.
Why does Tiffany Haddish, teacher, Carrie is her name, take Teddy to the ultimate fighting ring and, like, beat him up?
This film just takes these weird, unnecessary turns and excursions into, like, fantasy land that are so unnecessary. And I did read that I think this character, Tiffany Haddish's character, was originally meant to be the straight man to the Kevin Hart character. And yet when they decided they were going to have Tiffany Haddish take on that role, they're like, well, it's Tiffany Haddish. You got to let her be Tiffany Haddish and be her Girls Trippy kind of self. And so what happened is that the character loses any kind of arc that they might otherwise have had. And you have this film that's got all this talent and a decent premise. And if I had to just give it a pass-fail, Night School gets a fail for me.
Oh, that's a huge fail. Here's the quote I wrote down that really summarizes the movie. You either take that test or I'll tenderize your ass.
Gee, doesn't that sound brilliant? But I'll tell you, I've got to point out, though, that people around us did laugh. There were some people who really liked this movie. Mm. And just, I think, we're primed for a stupid comedy. And so there is that. And so if a stupid comedy, if you were okay with Ride Along 2, you're going to be fine with Night School.
Who in their right mind would have been okay with Ride Along 2?
I think some people were okay with Ride Along 2.
Terrible movie.
Exactly. But if you saw it and you liked it, then you're going to be okay with this one.
All right. Our next film, I think we're going to split a little bit. Because to me, It's rare that I love watching movies. I love it. It's just a break from life. Even the hard, heavy-hitting stuff that you don't like, I tend to like that too. But this one, Colette, to me actually felt like homework. Because I love learning from movies, and I learned a lot from this because I didn't know. I had no idea there was a very famous French novelist from the turn of the last century, turn into the 20th century, named Colette. I had no idea. I had no idea she was nominated for the Nobel Prize later in life. I had no idea that she wrote a couple of books with a central character called Claudine that transformed French society for about 5 years. I had no idea this is also the lady who wrote Gigi. I had no idea, so I really enjoyed learning. But I learned so much, and the pacing was so da-da-da-da-da and connect the dots. Colette, to me, felt like homework.
Well, see, maybe the pacing and that connect the dots is why I actually liked it when I normally don't like these period pieces. I agree with you 100% on every single first point you made there about I had no idea about any of this stuff either. Artie Chick reviewed it for Chick Flicks. I think she apparently did have some sense of who Colette was. Bad on me for not having ever heard of her before and not knowing really anything at all about this woman. But the thing is, it's Keira Knightley. And I think Keira Knightley plays essentially, I always feel like it's a bit the same role in all of the period pieces she does.
Yeah, I'm going to let you keep going, but I actually wrote this down. Period pieces starring Keira Knightley is its own genre.
It is.
She has never met a period piece where she didn't want to wallow and suffer.
But she does it so well. So for that, I think it succeeds. And Dominic West is playing her husband in this. So essentially, for anyone who doesn't know the story, which is probably most people who aren't familiar with French literature of the early 20th century, this woman marries a successful Parisian writer who uses ghostwriters, of which he makes his wife one of them. So he puts his name on all of these novels that she writes, this Claudine series, and so eventually that kind of blows up in his face because she wants and deserves some credit for it. And he sells the copyrights because he's in debt. And so it really is about Colette sort of gaining her independence and being this strong woman in this patriarchal society. And their very interesting marriage is really, it turns into something that's like an open marriage combined with a business partnership. For a while until they split. But he has affairs left and right, and she then starts having affairs with both men and women. And so it becomes a bit of a scandalous time in Paris. And so it is interesting, but I actually thought for a period piece, this one to me felt that it was a little more mainstream-ish. Like I could actually get, I was interested, I made it through. I liked it well enough. It's still not my genre of choice, but I think I ended up liking it more than you did.
I wonder if you liked it so much because it actually is a little bit contemporary because of its main theme, which is feminist. The patriarchy obviously extends well beyond 1900, but the cracks are starting to show. Women are starting to assert themselves more, and the men are not taking it too kind. The character arc is obvious. She goes from rural countryside naive waif to this cosmopolitan Parisian trying to stop suffocating under her emotionally abusive husband. Wash Westmoreland, he's the director. Wash Westmoreland, he directed Still Alice. Remember where Julianne Moore won every Best Actress award you could win? And he had been with his husband, who has since passed, by the way, from ALS.
Richard Glatzer.
He was percolating on this script for a very, very long time, and he actually met Colette's granddaughter, who is at least was still alive at the time. I don't know if she still is, but she had input and gave them the rights to use the Colette's actual words. So there's, you know, there's realism to the script. Things actually happened. There was a Marquise de Belbouffe. And here, see if you can answer it. I'm going to lob one at you. There's some realism in here. They spent some money on production design, and they certainly spent some money on dresses and costumes. Why is it in English?
I know. Isn't that the weirdest thing? Because here, it's like everyone's in Paris. She's writing. You see her writing in her notebooks in French, And yet the whole thing, everyone's speaking English.
British English.
And so, yes, I don't know. Do you have an answer to that? Yeah, it was. But remember, there was some movie we saw not too long ago, and you're like, everyone, it's in Russia, but everybody's speaking English.
This is not the first film to do it.
Right. And so they do it just to make it accessible to the American audience. So you kind of wonder what it might have been like if they had done it in French with English subtitles. You would have liked it more, I'm sure.
I would have loved it more if it was in French. I'm fine that it was Keira Knightley because listen to this list. The Duchess, Atonement, Pride and Prejudice, Anna Karenina, and to a certain extent, The Imitation Game. This is Keira Knightley's wheelhouse.
This is
what she does. So you already know if you're going to go see this. You're like, oh, I love Keira Knightley getting into old dresses.
But see, I don't. So this is sort of a departure for me because I haven't loved all those other movies because the genre is just not my cup of tea. So I think, one, there was a little bit of a personal connection, which I mentioned to you that the late Richard Glatzer, actually, I overlapped. I worked with him very briefly on America's Next Top Model. He was a story consultant on one season of Top Model. And so I remember just then seeing his name. I think he also did that Quinceanera. And so really did some good stuff. I mean, it was really sad that he had to battle ALS and died so young, relatively young. But I think, his husband Wash has really sort of been able to maintain the quality of material that they were developing. And so it just, I was glad to see that it was actually better than I expected. I didn't love it because it's just not the kind of movie that I generally love, but I liked it.
Well, it was a Toronto Film Festival one. Keira Knightley's fans are already screaming Oscar. I don't think she'll be nominated for anything.
No, it's too much like every other role.
Well, I mean, she did fine. She did just fine.
And Dominic West does he's very engaging in this, too.
He took a risk. We all know him from The Wire as McNulty, but he's actually British. And he had to make the choice to actually play this unlikable character. No one likes the guy who he plays Wally, so he had to do that. And Keira Knightley, she had to get a little bit physical for
Willie,
this.
Not Wally.
There's a big dance number, like sort of in the last third of the film. There's a big dance number when she comes out of the sarcophagus.
That's
a big dance scene, and then the near riot happens when she kisses the girl. So she's working her tail off in this film. She put in the effort noticeably. Bravo, but I don't see any awards coming her way.
Yeah, I don't either. And I do think that there was good chemistry between her and Dominic West. So I think the two of them combined helped make this movie work for an audience that could go slightly beyond the art house audience, which I think is always a good thing.
All right, our last two films are both documentaries. And the first one, man, audiences love Science Fair. They loved it at Sundance, where it won the Audience Award. They loved it at South by Southwest, where it won the Audience Award. And at Sun Valley Film Festival and the Portland Film Festival, where it all won the Audience Award. Note, it didn't win any of the official awards.
Right.
But audiences love this feel-good documentary about plucky high school students from around the globe as they compete at the 2017 International Science and Engineering Fair.
ICEF.
So... I don't know if you. It went through my mind as I was watching it. What the hell was I doing in high school?
It does make you feel like a major underachiever. That's for sure.
These kids are doing science. You remember the science fair? Kids would make a volcano.
That's right.
Or discover prisms. And these kids are. They're talking about words I couldn't still pronounce. And there's 1,700 of them. They all fly to Los Angeles, and we follow about 9 of them. Mostly U.S., but there's one from Brazil, one from Germany. There's a Muslim immigrant in South Dakota, and the rest are just normal high school kids. And we're going to see which one is named Best in Show. Best in Science Fair. So it was cute. It was like it wasn't Pick of the Litter cute. It was kind of like Pick of the Litter cute. I didn't connect, I don't think, as these film festival audiences are. I didn't fall head over heels in love with these kids.
I've seen the same documentary before about you pick the unknown subculture that exists and you go, oh my gosh, here's a peek behind the curtain and into this world that you really didn't know about and isn't this fascinating. And yeah, it's very interesting. And so I, for that, but it was just like if you saw Spellbound, you know, the National Geographic Bee, the kids who compete in that.
Very similar
to Spellbound, which I think was an influencer for the director. You know, Mad Hot Ballroom. There was all those movies about, like, chess, you know, the kids that compete in the chess clubs, the crossword puzzle one.
Wordplay.
And so to me, this was in that genre. It was very similar in structure. What this was missing that made it not quite work for me the way I think it could have or that the others did is that you don't see the payoff. They were not able to take their cameras into the actual judging portion of this fair. So you've got this international fair with like 1,700 students competing, and you know that these stakes are very high for these kids and for their teachers and their families. And yet the doors close, you know that all the judging has gone on, and the doors open, and you're at the award ceremony, and that's when you find out who won. And so to me, that's such a huge part of the drama and the payoff that you get in so many of these other documentaries that's a critical missing piece for me.
It did feel at times a bit repetitive, as, you know, they go to like the 2 days of setup, and you just keep seeing the pairs of children keep setting up. I was like, I get it already. But there's a deep theme that it touched on. And it should have hit harder than it didn't. The United States is systematically de-emphasizing science education in high schools. Should this feel as rare as it does? Probably not. This hits home with our girl from South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
She wears the hijab to school. She obviously sticks out in Lily White, South Dakota, which is built around its 0-9 football team.
That's right.
And she, the year before, won an award, was not recognized. She may win again. Would she be recognized? The school doesn't even know she exists. Like, the students are like, you mean we have one of those kids?
Yeah.
I don't even know. And that sticks. And these kids, they have charisma. Some of them are really witty. Like, I wrote down some of my favorite quotes. The better you are at science fair, the worse you are at dancing. Because they have a mixer. And I only listen to classical music and trap music. Okay, I don't really listen to classical.
Yeah, because you have this nerd in the back seat. I was like, what is trap music?
Oh, trap music is that subgenre of rap that's that southern slow drawl that, never mind, we'll get into it.
Yeah.
It didn't hit that what are we doing with science education theme, I think, hard enough.
Well, it had to hit something. Like, to me, it just never quite got there was not an emotional hook that I always feel like I got from some of these other documentaries at some point along the way. You don't quite know who you're rooting for, which is the nature of the filmmakers having to kind of go out and decide. They follow 9 students. And so you don't really know out of these 9 that they've chosen to follow, you know, how they're going to do in this very large international competition. But I think it is worth noting that the filmmaking team of this woman, Christina Costantini and Darren Foster, Costantini actually was in ISEF in like 2004, she made it to, I think, to that final round of competition. And so she actually was she felt like that's where she found her people. And even though she went on to become like an investigative journalist and documentary filmmaker, she recognized this story back then. And they do go and find like the very first winner of ISEF, and the first woman who won when they went co-ed with this competition. And so they talked about, and they're, you know, these are people who have gone on to very high level jobs. And they talk about the impact that ISEF had on their lives. So it's decades later. And so it really is about this competition, though, where these people really have found their people. They support each other's inventions and ideas, and it just it really is impressive. Like, you go, my goodness, these science nerds are going to be responsible for some of the most important developments in the world, and so you want to foster that. So I do agree, you're right with the need to make sure that there is a lesson to be learned here about the need for science education in U.S. schools. Because these people from around the world, I mean, there's a German kid who discovers some sort of wing.
It's aerodynamics.
Aerodynamic thing. But then there's this couple in a poor section of Brazil who are trying to figure out some cure for, like, the Zika virus. And then there's these three kids, one who looks like a surfer dude from some school in Louisiana.
In Kentucky.
That generates these science whizzes. And that's, like, two geeks and a surfer dude. So there's this trio of guys that they've created some kind of new stethoscope for the developing world. So, I mean, it's, and then there's the girl who is annoying, and you can't tell whether they're, like, intentionally trying to make her as annoying as can be or what you're supposed to make of her, who goes to school with these three guys and is, I don't know, she just, she goes back, like, every year to the science fair. So she is this some sort of child prodigy, and she's developing a device for testing for arsenic. And so her goal is to prevent cancer, not just cure cancer, but figure out a way to prevent it. So it's really an interesting group of people. There's also the guy Robbie, who is obviously the West Virginia one, who it's some kid who just basically fails out of school but is a genius for developing artificial intelligence kind of stuff. And has been rejected by all these colleges because his grades are so bad. And yet he gets to this high level in this international science fair. And his goal is, even though he rejects conventional education, is to somehow, you know, get himself into college. And you're rooting for him by the end to somehow just be recognized for the fact that he's just a nonconformist who could do really great things, and so you kind of have to embrace his quirkiness.
You reminded me of Skate Kitchen when he said she found her people.
It is. I mean, like, I think that's what all of these documentaries are. It's about how important it is to foster this environment for these students, and that they kind of learn from each other and they enjoy being around each other, because when they're in their individual schools, they're not appreciated for what they're doing. And yet when they're at this huge international competition, it's like, these are my people. This is my culture. These are, you know, even if it's the most uncomfortable looking mixer you could ever imagine, you can't help but just want all of them to succeed, because we're all going to be better off for it in the end if these kids manage to get the support that they need and the room to grow. So, you know, it'll be interesting in 50 years to see where these nine kids that they followed, what they're doing, and where they're working.
All right, our final film of the evening, who knows when you're listening to this, of this episode, is the documentary Hal. When I say Hal, I mean director Hal Ashby. This was at Sundance, and it was also at AFI Docs. This was the first film I saw of that film festival early in the morning, and I thought it was a very good film to kick off three straight days of 15 movies, because it's about movies. It's about a man. It's about a creative, nonconformist making unique movies, which are so far standing the test of time. Hal Ashby, you can call him an obsessive genius. He created this unprecedented string of classics. We're talking about Harold and Maude, Shampoo, Being There, Coming Home, The Last Detail, and I've seen some of those. I've seen, you know, Harold and Maude and Being There, and they're really amazing films. However, as his contemporaries are Francis Ford Coppola, Martin Scorsese, George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, they rose to blockbuster stardom in the 1980s. Hal Ashby didn't. He fell off a cliff in the 80s, and the film is saying the 1970s as a decade was more idealistic, more experimental. The 1980s morphed into capitalism, and Ashby did not mix with that. He bucked the studio. He fought with the studio. You know, if he's making a movie, it's his creative control, and it you know, who even cares what the audiences want or if it'll make any money? That's not the point of filmmaking, Hannah.
Well, but I think he's showing, this documentary is showing how in the 1970s, when he had this string of hits, he fought the studios and the studios kind of backed down. Like, he just refused to listen to when the studio would say, we're going to recut this ourselves. He would be like, no, I'm not giving you the footage. And by the 80s, I think the studios had enough power and just were like, we're not going to hire you anymore. You're not going to play by our rules. Then so be it. And so that was really his downfall, is that he was very outspoken. And Ben Foster's reading these letters
He's a good narrator, Ben Foster. Great narrator.
Yeah. So he's reading these letters that Hal Ashby wrote and typed out during, to the studio heads and stuff, basically saying, F you, if you think you're going to touch my movie. And so it's sad and funny at the same time to kind of see how his creative control led to some genius, but also an implosion of his career. So it was an interesting one, but this is definitely one of those documentaries that's for the cinephile. It was very much a lot. It reminded me of The Film Worker that we saw.
It's nowhere near as cerebral as that.
No, but it's that same. But I think that audience, like, if you really appreciate that behind the scenes, if you know these films, like I knew I'd seen Harold and Maude, and I think I vaguely remember seeing Being There. But these others, and I remember seeing the pictures of Warren Beatty and Shampoo. You know, like I the visual sticks with me. But I haven't seen all these guys' movies, and I certainly didn't know his name. And so it really is another one of those inside baseball movie documentaries. And so I think if you just don't know, if none of these movie titles ring a bell, then it's going to be harder to really appreciate the inside, behind the scenes kind of view that all the talking heads are giving you in this particular doc.
In 2018, people still do go back to watch early Spielberg and early Coppola, but only, you got this right here, only cinephiles will still go back to watch Ashby. He's on Turner Classic Movies all the time, but I think only a certain sect a movie fan is watching that. I am. But I think it shows he is still influential today. There's a whole laundry list of movie stars from the 70s that are interviewed here, but also contemporary directors who didn't know Ashby, but who incorporated his lessons. I'm talking David O. Russell is probably his direct descendant. So is Alexander Payne and even Judd Apatow. They're all interviewed, and they say how much of an influence Hal Ashby's films were on them. And when you think about that, wow, they really are. When you think of Silver Linings Playbook or American Hustle or Nebraska or Sideways, like, that's a Hal Ashby flavor. So that's why I really connected with Hal.
Well, you talk about how at least if you learn something from these documentaries, then they're worthwhile. And I think you do learn something from this. You also learn that Hal, who unfortunately died relatively young, I think he was 59. He died in the late 80s of pancreatic cancer. And so, you know, you just don't know whether his career would have turned around at some point and what he might have created. But this documentary really seeks to show how Ashby was what we would call woke now. He was woke to race relations and, the anti-Vietnam War. He just took a stand very early on for a lot of things, and so he also was the editor on. So he was an editor turned director. So he won an Oscar for editing In the Heat of the Night, and he was very obsessive compulsive about protecting how he edited that film too. And so I really did enjoy some of the backstory about that. And And there was a movie called The Landlord Bo Bridges was in. And I can't remember who the other person was. Lou Gossett Jr. maybe.
Yeah.
And just really great little vignettes of stories about how they were like shooting The Landlord in some, neighborhood that was not a mixed neighborhood in New York. And Louis Gossett Jr. basically had to protect the Bridges character because people didn't realize they were shooting a film. And it's like, what's this white boy doing in this hood running through the neighborhood? And so little things like that were just sort of fascinating glimpses and insight into that filmmaking process. And you can't really – it just showed how the pros and the cons of being so obsessive about your work. And he also was a heavy pot smoker. And so the drugs, I think, were, you know, part of what got him into trouble with the studios and things too. But it definitely an interesting thing. If you really have never heard of Hal Ashby, or if you've heard about Hal Ashby and are familiar with that string of 1970s films, then, you know, you might get a kick out of some of the backstory.
Most importantly, he explains the end of Being There. It's a very, very famous ending of that movie. If you've ever seen it, Peter Sellers' character does something, and no one ever knew what it meant. Like, we all had our guesses what it meant, but he actually says, well, what a, look at it this way. And I thought, oh my lord, now that right there is the whole reason to watch this movie, explain the end of Being There. So yeah, I got a kick out of Hal.
That was good.
All right, quick recap. Night School is just garbage.
Save it. I mean, don't pay for it. But if you need to kill 2 hours on an airplane someday, then it's harmless.
Colette is, it will make you smarter.
You know, if you need to catch up, yes, that's true. If you want to be able to name drop a famous French novelist from the early 20th century, then it helps to have seen Colette and Keira Knightley and Dominic West give good performances.
Science Fair will actually make you feel stupid. These 16-year-olds know a lot more about science than you do.
Yeah, those like potato clocks and stuff that you always worked on wouldn't quite get you where these kids are going.
And Hal, it just, for those of us that missed the 70s, is a good wrap-up of what I missed.
Well, and I was watching, you know, I was young back then, Charlie, so I was watching TV. I was really into like just cheesy 70s and 80s, early 80s television. So I certainly did not know of Hal Ashby, and I wasn't watching any of these movies. They were way above my interest at the time. And so, yeah, again, you learn something. It's solid. It's solid.
Go look up right now the movie poster for Harold and Maude. It just says Harold and Maude in a white background because the studio saw the movie and they had no idea what to do with it. Yeah. And it's perfect. No one knows what to do with that movie. That's what's so great about it.
And that is, that's the best part of this documentary, is those little tidbits that you just learn that do make you appreciate just how the creative control that this guy insisted on and why. And he just stood up for his art and stuck to his guns. And it was like, studios be damned.
Very good. Perfect ending. Thank you very much for listening to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.